Governor-elect Tony Evers and Lieutenant Governor-elect Mandela Barnes will be sworn into office in about 4 hours, and we will carry the ceremony for you live beginning at 11. And on this Inauguration Day, we're focusing on what to watch for here on the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Sean Johnson is covering the swearing-in minute by minute. He's WPR News' State Capitol Bureau Chief and co-host of the WPR Politics podcast. Sean, thanks for making time for us on a busy day.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so we know 11 o'clock this ceremony begins, but break down some of the time elements here as to what will happen in the ceremony.
You're going to see all of Wisconsin's constitutional officers sworn in. So Tony Evers, the Attorney General, the Treasurer, Secretary of State, Lieutenant Governor. This is the moment when it all happens. It will be, you know, heavy on the ceremony, I guess. This is not like exactly like a state of the state or, you know, a budget address type thing in the world of state government. You'll have bands playing, you know, children singing, literally. That's kind of what the event that this is going to be. And then you'll have a speech from now governor-elect, soon to be governor, Tony Evers.
So what will you be watching for in the inaugural address?
I guess I'll be watching Evers' speech to hear what he hints at when, you know, when he gives this speech. And it'll probably be similar to the things that he's talked about on, you know, the campaign, since the campaign. There's been a consistent theme along there, but there, you know, you watch for nuggets of something new in a speech like this. This is his first speech as governor, and I kind of remember the tone of Governor Walker's first speech as governor in the inaugural, and he was kind of talking about big things coming, and we didn't know what that meant at that time, because he didn't really specify, but it ended up being a big hint of things to come. So, you know, we'll see what's in Governor-elect Evers' speech. He obviously faces different circumstances than Governor Walker did when he was first sworn in 8 years ago.
So, right, more power is limited. But remind us, what are some of the consistent themes that Evers has brought up on the campaign trail and here as he gets closer to office?
I think the theme that is probably most consistently brought up, but hardest to measure, is this idea that he wants to be the governor that brings back civility. He is not a rhetorical bomb thrower, you know, by any means. He did some of that during the Democratic primary for governor, where he would kind of talk tough in a speech, and it was unnatural. Mm. You know, it's not something that he does particularly well. And so when he talks about, you know, civility consistently, I guess we'll have to see what that means to Governor Evers. I completely expect that to be a big theme of this speech today. I think you'll also see him talk quite a bit about what has been his day job for the rest of his career. You know, some form of a job in education, currently the state superintendent of public instruction. And he prioritized schools, school funding in his campaign. I'm sure it's going to be kind of the, you know, the foundation of his upcoming budget. So I expect you'll hear a lot about that in his speech as well.
He had kid events around the state this weekend as part of his gala activities. Is that right?
Yeah. And so in case you were missing that message, that's kind of where he's coming from and you know, what he hopes to bring to the governorship. He's laying that out there pretty consistently.
Sean Johnson is WPR's State Capitol Bureau Chief. We're talking about what to look for on this inaugural day. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What message would you share with Governor-elect Tony Evers on this day? What questions do you have about the proceedings? What issues do you want the new governor and the legislature to work on? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@WPR.org. Sean, how does this inauguration compare to those of Governor Walker?
I think in terms of the way that the ceremony looks today, it's just going to be different people up there. They'll be very similar in terms of the look, the feel of the rotunda, the way that it gets all decorated. That, you know, you'll recognize it as an inauguration. I think the circumstances are much different, though, for Tony Evers than they were for Scott Walker back in January of 2011. Remember, Scott Walker back in January of 2011 was coming into office at the same time that new Republican majorities were coming into office in the state assembly and in the state Senate. And so that wasn't just Scott Walker's moment in 2011. That was viewed as the Republican moment. That was the, you know, if they're ever going to change anything, this was their chance to do it. It was the refrain that you heard from them back in 2011. Tony Evers won't have the luxury of single party control. So whatever he wants to do is going to take a bipartisan agreement, you know, in most cases. He can still issue some executive orders, although how much oomph they would have as an executive order, you know, is doubtful. So most of what he does, most of what he does is going to require Republican support. And so he has to propose a different kind of agenda. He either has to propose things knowing that they are going to fail in the legislature, and so they're sort of symbolic, or he's proposing stuff that he's really reaching out toward the middle.
And in leading up to the inauguration, Governor-elect Evers, he's been doing these interviews on what's ahead for the state, and there's been a bit of a back and forth this week on whether the Evers administration would follow laws passed in the most recent lame duck session. Does he have any latitude there, Sean? And what's going on there?
I think it kind of boiled down to interviews that he gave with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And, you know, potentially just the way that he described how these lawsuits might unfold. You know, we all presume there are going to be lawsuits involving the recent lame duck session and the restrictions on power in the governor's office. We still don't know what form those are going to take. And so Tony Evers hinted that he might be the defendant in those lawsuits. That is, you know, somebody might sue him in some way versus him, you know, coming in and like proactively trying to sue to overturn these laws. He clarified the next day that that does not mean he's going to break the law. He says, I'm not going to break the law. So, you know, read into that what you will. As state superintendent, he's actually been the subject of a lawsuit. And I think he's been on the side of challenging a law that restricted his powers there. So, you know, it's really just kind of talking about the mechanics of how a lawsuit might get started. Evers, at least when he spoke on Thursday, didn't sound at all like he was going to ignore these lame duck session laws that were passed that restricted his power.
And he's been doing budget listening sessions around the state. You spoke with him about what his budget might look like. What did he have to say when it comes to taxes?
With taxes, it's interesting because one of the things that he proposed toward the end of the campaign, that is, you know, you didn't hear him talking about it during the most of, you know, the rest of the year that he campaigned for governor, was this tax cut, this 10% tax cut for people who make up to $100,000, families that make up to $150,000. You know, that came out, toward the very end of the campaign. And so, you know, my question for the governor, and I think a lot of people had the same question, is that going to be in your budget? And he said, yes. This is something that Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald has said he likes. But Evers said that he's glad to hear that, but that Senator Fitzgerald did not say okay to the other side of that, which is in order to pay for this sizable new income tax cut, Evers wants to scale back an existing tax credit for manufacturers so that it only covers the first $300,000 of their income. So he says we can do the income tax cut. We just have to have a way to pay for it.
Give and take there. Governor-elect Tony Evers is finalizing cabinet appointments and planning for what he'll do in his first week in office. We're talking here on this inauguration day with Sean Johnson, WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief. You have a line at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about today's proceedings and traditions? What issues do you want the new governor-elect to take up? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll be back in a moment on the Ideas Network.
A winter storm warning is in effect for Forest, Florence, Northern Marinette, and Northern Oconto counties. A winter weather advisory is in effect north of a line from Appleton to Eau Claire. And we're expecting heavy snow in the northeast, possibly 3 to 8 inches of it, followed by a wintry mix, rain in the rest of the state, windy in the east, and highs in the 40s. For Tuesday, windy with light snow and highs in the mid to upper 30s. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Governor-elect Tony Evers says he'll start his first week on the job by touring the troubled Lincoln Hills Juvenile Prison. But his first moments on the job will begin with a swearing-in ceremony that will start at 11 this morning. We're carrying it live, anchored by WPR's Sean Johnson and WPT's Frederica Freiberg. We're going through what to watch for on this inauguration day, and Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson has stopped by to help us out. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Here's a question for you. If you would go through the receiving line this afternoon outside the governor's office, when it got to your turn, what would you say to Governor-elect Evers? What would your brief exchange be with him? And what do you want his administration to work on? You can call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Sean, in your recent sit down and talk with Evers, you spoke about this budget, and we were talking about taxes, but there's also school funding, there's transportation. What else do we know about what this budget might look like?
A couple of things that Evers was most definitive about included school funding and then Medicaid expansion, federal Medicaid expansion. So the school funding, he said, everything I campaigned on, I'm going to do. You're going to have a $1.4 billion budget for K-12 education. That includes a 10% increase. He wants one thing that he did talk about that he hadn't talked about really much on the campaigns, that he wants to have voucher school costs included on property tax bills. So the same way that other local units of government are itemized on your property tax bill, Tony Evers says he wants to see that with voucher schools. He says that would start a conversation around vouchers. With Medicaid expansion, this is something that the Governor Scott Walker has declined to do during his administration. And Republicans and the legislature have, by and large, had the governor's back on that one. And when we talk about federal Medicaid expansion, we're talking about expanding Medicaid beyond just people who are at 100% of the federal poverty level. It's on up to 133% of the federal poverty level, so people with slightly higher incomes. And in exchange for that, Wisconsin would qualify for more federal funding, federal Medicaid funding, made possible through the Affordable Care Act. This is something that the governor has said. The state can't rely on the Affordable Care Act could go away. The federal government could go back on its promise, other states have taken this. If Wisconsin had taken this, it would have received roughly north of $1 billion in federal funding since 2014. So this is something that Tony Evers is going to make a big deal out of. Again, Republicans have been pretty clear, especially Speaker Voss has been clear about not wanting to do this. So it could end up being kind of one of those symbolic things, or it could end up being one of those things that, sets up a room for compromise come July, August, September, whenever they work out this budget.
How have Republican leaders in the legislature reacted to some of these policy suggestions and these proposals? Is there any sense of improvement of working across the aisle here?
Not too much. With Fitzgerald, initially there was, when Senator Fitzgerald did a year-end news conference, he talked about not ruling out the federal Medicaid expansion, which that's not a ringing endorsement of it by any means. But at that moment, he wasn't ready to say, no, we're not doing this. So that was interesting. Speaker Voss has basically said, we're not doing this. And of course, we just had a session a month ago where Republicans restricted Tony Evers' powers. So I wouldn't say that the relationship is great, but a lot of this stuff that Evers is talking about now has been out there previously. And the one thing that you did see Fitzgerald react to last week was when Evers was talking about scaling back the tax credit for manufacturers. Fitzgerald said, no, he's talking about raising taxes on businesses right away, and I don't support that.
Is there any sense that his cabinet appointments have given us any glimpse into an effort for bipartisanship or an effort toward working with the other party?
I don't know. I mean, I've heard some people describe them as pragmatic picks. There have been some people, Republicans, Speaker Voss particularly, criticizing Evers for picking too many people from Milwaukee and Madison. One pick that was interesting last week was Peter Barca, state representative who was the minority leader for Democrats during the tumultuous battle over Act 10 and everything else during the, you know, the Walker administration, really. I mean, he was that the voice of the opposition in the assembly for those years. Peter Barca left the minority leader's job after he voted for the Foxconn incentives bill. Foxconn would be located near his district in Kenosha. He was one of a couple Democrats who voted for it, one of a few. And so his pick was celebrated by Republicans. They said, you know, Evers got it right here. We like working with Peter Barca. So, you know, that's one that we'll see. It could depend on what Peter Barca does, as if he is Secretary of the Department of Revenue, there could be policies within the Department of Revenue in the department's budget, for example, that Republicans don't care for, and all that goodwill could be forgotten quickly.
Let's go to Don joining us in Madison. Don, hi.
Hi. A few months ago, my wife had to replace her driver's license, and I discovered, being a resident on the west side of Madison, she had to go to someplace west of the Beltline, difficult to find. And this in spite of the fact that we have a brand new administration building near Hillsdale, which is pretty convenient, but without a driver's license office at Hillsdale. They just put state ID and driver's licenses in an inaccessible spot. I think that the governor, if possible, should review the location of all such offices in every county in the state, and to make sure that they're in a convenient spot so people can get state IDs and driver's licenses.
Don, thanks so much for the call. So Don would really like to bring DMV into sharper focus for the Evers administration and having more convenient locations.
It has been a while since we've talked about this, but this has actually been an issue that came up in state government several years ago when the Republican legislature was at that time weighing a voter ID bill, which is now law in Wisconsin. Critics were saying, look, if you're going to do this, you need to have more DMV locations throughout the state, because in Indiana, where voter ID was upheld, and, you know, voter ID has been upheld here in Wisconsin, too. But at the time, Indiana was sort of the template of what was constitutional, and they had a lot more DMV locations than we did here in Wisconsin. So, you know, maybe that is something that would happen. I haven't heard Evers talk about that yet.
Evers is scheduled to visit Lincoln Hills School for Boys, one of the state's juvenile prisons, during his time in office. And the trip comes as the state prepares to close Lincoln Hills. So what's the goal there and the message to say, you know, in my first week, I'm going to go to Lincoln Hills?
It's a symbolic message, largely. I mean, Evers described it as somewhat of a fact-finding mission, but he acknowledged that a lot of the facts are out there at this point with regard to Lincoln Hills, and the allegations of inmate abuse and unsafe working conditions for guards have been widely reported on. But Evers, for him, it's a way to make a symbolic break from Governor Scott Walker. I mean, it's going to be hard for Evers to accomplish anything, really, from the get-go, because he doesn't have the powers that Walker did to, you know, kind of rescind some of these programs, these federal waivers for things like work requirements for people receiving food share. That power has been taken away from him. He doesn't have the power that Walker had of having allies in the state legislature to just say, here's a bill I want, pass it, and they do it. That's not going to happen for Evers. But what he can do with this trip to Lincoln Hills is something Walker didn't do, and that is visit a Wisconsin correctional institution. Walker made a point of not visiting Lincoln Hills or any other prison. So this is a symbolic gesture by Evers to do that in his first week. He said he wants the people who work there and the people who are in custody there to know that their governor cares about them.
In the few moments we have left, do we know Governor Scott Walker has addressed his next steps, talked a little bit about his political future, making some speeches? What do we know?
He talked to the Associated Press about this on Friday, and a couple of things that got people's attention was when he talked about 2022. That is going to be the next time Wisconsin has a race for governor and the next time Wisconsin has a race for U.S. Senate. And Walker didn't rule out running for either of those offices. He said that as far as the governor's office goes, he expects that Republicans might want a fresh face, you know, in that race. But he said never say never. And then in the U.S. Senate, that would be Ron Johnson's seat. Ron Johnson has said he's going to leave office after two terms. You know, people change those pledges all the time. But if Ron Johnson sticks to that, Scott Walker is saying, you know, I'm not ruling out running for that in 4 years.
Well, Sean, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Sean Johnson is WPR's State Capitol Bureau Chief. He also co-hosts the WPR Politics podcast. The inauguration of Governor Tony Evers will air on Wisconsin Public Radio today at 11. Sean and WPT's Frederica Freiberg are hosting it. You can listen here on the Ideas Network or at WPR.org. Up next, it's news. Then our guest from Wisconsin Department of Health Services is here to take a look at the dementia plan, which aims to improve facility care, community care, and more. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Wisconsin's Department of Health Services, DHS, has been working with people across the state to design a new state dementia plan. The plan's goals and strategies are tailored to Wisconsin and meant to be a guide for improving care and services for people with dementia and their caregivers. We're taking a closer look at the new plan here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And we want to hear from you. How has dementia or Alzheimer's disease affected your community? What about your family? Are you a caregiver? What do you and the person you care for need? How can state support you and your community? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Carrie Mulkey. She is chair of the State Plan Steering Committee and director of the Bureau of Aging and Disability Resources for the Department of Health Services. Carrie, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And another Carrie as well. Carrie Patterson is here. She's co-author of the State Plan Steering Committee and executive director for the Alzheimer's Association South Central Wisconsin chapter. Carrie Patterson, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having us.
Well, let's start with Carrie Mulkey. Give us a sense of how many Wisconsinites are impacted by dementia-related illnesses.
Absolutely. So, our current statistics indicate that about 110,000 Wisconsin residents that are 65 years and older had dementia in 2018, which is about 1 in 9 people. Mm. It is the fifth leading cause of death for people 65 and older. And what I would say, too, about this particular disease is that it impacts more than just individuals that have the disease. It really impacts communities and it impacts caregivers. And so just to give you some additional statistics, I would offer that about 200,000 caregivers provided about 220 million hours of unpaid care this last year. And so when we look collectively at the people that are impacted, like I said, about 110,000 Wisconsin residents that have the disease, but then about another 200,000 caregivers are impacted as well.
And certainly caregivers are there hour by hour, and they're really side by side with this disease. Is that right, Carrie Mulkey?
They are, absolutely. They are really the backbone of our long-term care system. And I think the other critical thing to consider about caregivers is that it impacts them pretty significantly, too. It can impact their own health. It can impact their own stress levels. So it's really important that caregivers are also taking care of themselves, but also recognizing how important they are to those individuals that they are serving with this particular disease. There are people who are familiar to them, and when you do have memory issues and memory loss, having someone in your life, like a natural caregiver, like a spouse or a family member, can be very, very beneficial to people who are living with Alzheimer's disease and dementia.
Carrie Patterson, let's take a minute here for a bit of policy history. This isn't Wisconsin's first dementia care plan. What did the previous plan, known as the Wisconsin Dementia Care System Redesign Plan, allow the state to do?
Sure. So the first time we really took an opportunity to look at how Wisconsin can respond to dementia and especially crisis situations where there's maybe an escalated situation where law enforcement or other service providers might become impacted, we're looking at how we can respond to vulnerable adults with a diagnosis and what our systems really can handle for emergency management situations. So it happened with something called the Helen EF decision back in about 2013, I believe it was. And we've adapted some awareness initiatives because not everyone is understanding how to adapt and respond to someone with a dementia behavior, or maybe it's something more on a hallucination or delirium sort of a situation with a family member. And so we took our first look at how we can expand awareness and education efforts from a multiple levels of service providers, whether it's EMT or fire or police staff, to really help and see how we can train them in the general community for awareness initiatives. So the first plan was really larger in scope and trying to see what the needs really were of the state, and we've kind of grown from there.
Carrie Patterson, what did we learn from the first plan? It was broader, as you said, but what did we learn from it?
Well, I think our main findings were really that so many facets of our general community are impacted by dementia. I think when people think of the word Alzheimer's, they kind of think it later in life. And maybe someone who's 80 years old and really kind of just homebound, but there's so much to this disease. People can live with a dementia for anywhere from 8 to 20 plus years with this in varying forms and stages. So we learned how to communicate with caregivers earlier. A lot of people come to our service providers, whether it's a state agency or a care community, at a time of their greatest need, but it's been probably happening in their family life for quite some time. So sometimes it's a point of crisis where people feel the need to reach out and then do their planning in that state of mind instead of having a well-thought-out care plan earlier in the disease course where we can actually involve the person living with a dementia.
Carrie Patterson is with us, Executive Director of the Alzheimer's Association Southeastern Wisconsin Chapter. Carrie Mulkey as well directs the Bureau of Aging and Disability Resources for the State Department of Health Services. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you live with a dementia, do you feel there is a stigma about your diagnosis? And what challenges do you face? What successes have you found? Caregivers, what do you wish your community and your state officials knew about what it's like supporting someone with a dementia diagnosis? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Carrie Mulkey, the priorities in this new plan are spread around four big major areas. So what does this plan call for when it comes to improving care in the community?
Yeah, absolutely. And if I could actually springboard a little bit off of what Carrie Patterson said a moment ago and refer back to some of the things that we learned, we really learned how important community is. The majority of people are living in the community with dementia. And so really investing in our communities is a critical component. And we learned that there are certain efforts and initiatives that we can institute with the help of local communities and advocacy and so on that can really impact and make a difference. We spent a lot of time in the state building dementia-friendly communities and creating safe places for people with dementia and their caregivers to go in the community. And so this next plan, so the first plan started in 2014, And so it's been 5 years. We can't believe that it's been 5 years already. And so a group of stakeholders, again, came together in 2018, in the spring of 2018, to plan for the next 5 years. And so that's where we're at right now, is the plan that we're speaking about today is a plan for the next 5 years. And there are four categories within this next plan, as you mentioned. And the first one is care in the community. There's also healthcare, and there's strategies underneath healthcare. There's also crisis response for people with dementia, which Carrie Patterson was mentioning was in some ways the impetus for us to begin a redesign effort in the first place back in 2013 and 14. And then the last category is facility-based care. So now to get back in and answer the question that you originally asked. So care in the community, we have two strategies. And these strategies are high-level strategies. The whole plan actually sets a course for what we want to do, but it doesn't really set a course for how we're going to do it. So the first strategy under care in the community is to increase understanding and reduce the stigma associated with a dementia diagnosis. So I appreciate that you're asking your audience to call in and let us know whether they feel that this disease is stigmatized. We certainly feel like it is. We feel like this is one of those diseases that is most feared by many people, and as a result of that fear, they put off going to the doctor and talking to them about their memory loss. And so, and also just over our lifetime, you know, it really is one of those things when we think about a health concern or issue that we don't ever want to get, this one tends to be at the top of the list. So there is a lot of stigma associated with the dementia diagnosis, because, and there's so much misunderstanding associated with it as well. So that's the first body of work that we're looking to dig into, is how can we reduce that stigma and increase understanding.
Yeah.
The second, yeah.
And I want to just pause right there.
Sure.
What would a dementia-friendly community look like? You know, how does a community be able to carry that moniker?
Yeah, so dementia-friendly, what it really means is, let me put it this way. When you develop this disease, what often happens is people become isolated. They have a difficult time engaging sometimes in conversations. Things become confusing or unfamiliar. And what it does is prevents people from going out into the community. And so what develops when you have a dementia-friendly community is that organizations all across that community, all of the businesses, the public entities, libraries, our banks and credit unions, and you know, really just all sorts of agencies across our communities learn about dementia. They learn about the physical environment associated with dementia. So, for example, grocery stores that might make changes to their physical environment on a regular basis, you know, changing where the meat and potatoes are is confusing to all of us, but it is it's very confusing to people with dementia. So thinking about things like that are critically important.
And I'm going to pause right there. There are 9 priority goals, 38 strategies that form the basis of the new state dementia plan. We're going into the details here on the morning show. Carrie Mulkey and Carrie Patterson are our guides. Carrie Mulkey directs the Bureau of Aging and Disability Resources for DHS. Carrie Patterson, Executive Director of the Alzheimer's Association South Central Wisconsin Chapter. U of a Line, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Goal number 4 of the new state dementia plan is to ensure that healthcare providers are dementia capable so that people with dementia and their families receive high quality care in the most effective and least restrictive environment possible. We're going into the details of this new plan, learning what dementia capable means for Wisconsin. You have a line at 800-642-1234. Do you work in a facility that provides care for people with dementia-related illnesses? What is that experience like? What are your needs? Do you provide emergency care in your community? What have you seen when it comes to helping patients with a dementia diagnosis? What do you need to better support them? Join in at 800-642-1234. Carrie Mulkey stays with us. She's chair of the State Plan Steering Committee and director of the Bureau of Aging and Disability Resources at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Carrie Patterson also in this conversation. She co-chairs the State Plan Steering Committee and is executive director of the Alzheimer's Association South Central Wisconsin chapter. Let's go to the phones now, and Jody is joining us from North Freedom. Good morning, Jody.
Good morning.
Go ahead with your thoughts on this.
Well, I've been a caregiver for many years, and I mean, as I told the person who answered the phone, I listened to your plan, and it seems to address what I now call the happy phase of dementia. I have found that the state of Wisconsin and counties specifically are horribly ill-equipped to deal with a patient who becomes agitated or violent or has an episode of striking out. Right now in this state, the only option is a facility like Mendota, which is not totally appropriate. It's not the least restrictive environment, and it drains a family both emotionally and financially.
Jody, thank you so much for calling in with that perspective. Carrie Mulkey, let's start with you on the restrictive environment and when someone with dementia becomes combative.
Absolutely. So this plan is really multifaceted, and we haven't yet spoken to the efforts that we do absolutely agree with Jody need to be made related to crisis response, basically, for people with dementia. And this is a challenge. I would say the last 5 years we have tried a number of different things. We've piloted a number of different programs to really try and address this and create alternatives to mental health institutions. The law has clarified that dementia is not a mental health disorder, and so it isn't viewed as an appropriate place for somebody with dementia to go. What we're trying to target actually in this area is to respond to crises in place first and foremost, to stabilize in place. And so by doing things like training our first responders and our county crisis system workers to understand this disease, know how to diffuse the disease, to understand that behaviors are a form of communicating. It's not that a person is intentionally being violent, but that we need to seek the rationale for or the what that person is trying to communicate with us. And then there's the second phase, because not everybody can have that stabilization in place. And so what options are there for those folks? Where can they go? And we are still looking to build those resources either in facility-based care or hospitals have been taking more of a brunt of that. People are being admitted to ERs and are staying there for too long, perhaps. They need a place to go and a way to return home. So it is absolutely, we absolutely agree with Jody that there is more that needs to happen in this area, which is why that is one of the four categories of this new plan.
Jody, thank you so much for the call. Let's go to Monette waiting in La Crosse. Hi, Monette.
Hello. I'm glad there are more and more shows like this about our future, basically. We all are either going to be dead or we're going to be cared for. And I've been dealing for 2 years with two parents with dementia, my sister and I, and we did put them in a facility. But it's been a learning experience to the point that even another friend of mine who's also been a caretaker, we both just talked last night and said that we really don't have much faith in the system as it is right now, and that we want to find another way to go out of this earth than to go to any facility. And I've talked with states, both Wisconsin and Minnesota, ombudsmen, social workers, and what I've gleaned from everything is that, number one, when a parent is in assisted living, the rules and regulations are not as strong as nursing home regulations. And then you're dealing with a population that cannot express themselves, or if they push a button to get help, by the time the help comes, they've forgotten what they need unless they're laying on the floor and it's obvious. So a lot of times patients will keep quiet because they know they can't remember what they need anyway, so they'll sit and just be uncomfortable or maybe be laying on the floor.
Monette, let's pause right there. Thank you so much for speaking up. Carrie Patterson, how do federal regulations for care intersect with what Wisconsin is trying to do to accomplish with this plan?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we look at facility-based care, there is a real need to ensure that there is consistent and high quality and appropriate care. And so, Monette, when you were speaking, having two parents, gosh, that is incredibly challenging when you have to look at options for care outside of the home. And I think a lot of people don't realize how much care really falls on adult children who kind of step into a role of helping to select a care community when they do need help. And that is happening more and more. But what we're seeing in facility-based care is that there is a lot of difference when it comes to training of the frontline staff, how much they're willing and able to do with each individual. And this plan addresses some questions of, you know, maybe there will be in the future some sort of recommendations or credentialing changes to those care communities that will help a family like yours, Monette, select a best level care, one that does good work and has adequate training for all of their front level staff. We don't know what that training might be or what those recommendations might be since we're very early into this new phase. However, we do know that that is your number one concern. You want to make sure that your loved one is treated well and the staffing is appropriate for how many residents live in each community, and all of those are going to be looked at in greater detail in coming years. So we're happy that you're sharing that perspective, because that is certainly something that I would want to see if I was making that choice too. I agree with you.
In the limited time we have left, we all have a role here in supporting people with dementia and the people, the caregivers, the people who care for them. Is there a way that people can help more? Carrie Mulkey first. How can people help or volunteer perhaps?
Yeah, we actually have a whole section here too looking at caregivers. And one of the things that we could use from caregivers is their experience and their support for other caregivers. At the summit that we had caregivers there, and they mentioned how important peer mentoring is. So continuing to do the important caregiving work is critical, and then also engaging others is just an absolutely fabulous role that caregivers can play for their communities.
Well, Carrie Mulkey and Carrie Patterson, thank you both for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Carrie Mulkey is chair of the State Plan Steering Committee and director of the Bureau of Aging and Disability Resources at Wisconsin's DHS. Carrie Patterson is co-chair of the State Plan Steering Committee and executive director of the Alzheimer's Association South Central Wisconsin chapter. They joined us to look at the Wisconsin State Dementia Plan. By the way, you can find a link to the plan on the morning show page on WPR.org. Just ahead, get your questions about WPR ready, because it's time for Mondays with Mike. What do you like about WPR? What do you want us to do better? Let us know by calling 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.